In semiconductors, we're all familiar with Moore's law, where the number of transistors is doubling every time period. And in biology, we face Eroom's law, which is the opposite, which says the cost of a drug is improving sort of in line with Moore's law. And the cost of that drug is not because drug hunters are being frivolous. It's not that we're spending money for the sake of it. It's that it's getting harder. And so there's more failure. And then the failure rate has not really changed over many years. We're still today, 90% of drugs that are discovered are failing before they reach the market.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Imagine being able to design the perfect drug molecule from scratch, one that could cure diseases with unprecedented efficacy and minimal side effects. This is the ambitious vision driving Rodeos, a human-enabled, machine-driven drug design company focused on biomedical research and drug discovery. By leveraging generative AI and machine learning, Rodeos aims to design and build mini-proteins as therapeutics with the potential to revolutionize medicine. In this episode, Dave Longo, the CEO of Rodeos, discusses the challenges faced by the pharmaceutical industry, such as high failure rates and rising costs, and how Rodeos is tackling these issues by designing optimal drug molecules upfront using AI and technology. Dave will share Rodeos' unique approach, which involves using mini-agent systems and distributed learning to model complex biological systems like proteins. You'll hear about their Symphony of Models approach, which creates better protein designs, and how they draw from diverse backgrounds spanning computer science, mathematics, music production, and biology. Your host for this episode is Yin He, Principal Business Development for Healthcare and Life Sciences Startups at AWS. Yin will guide us through this fascinating conversation, exploring the potential of AI to revolutionize drug discovery and the future of medicine. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm excited to guest host this session today. My name is Yin He, and I lead our work with early stage healthcare and life sciences startups and investors at AWS. I'm trained as a wet lab scientist, PhD in molecular bio and genomics. Prior to AWS, I was an early employee and operator at a venture-backed startup building cloud labs and software tools to help pharma and biotech accelerate drug discovery. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by Dave Longo, CEO and co-founder of Rodeos. I had the pleasure of first meeting Dave during his time at an accelerator, StartX, and then getting to know him more as part of the AWS Generative AI Accelerator that we ran for our top Gen AI startup. Dave, welcome. Let's dig in, and I'm looking forward to learning more about your founder journey and how Rodeos came to be.
Thank you for having me. All
right, to kick us off, just tell us a little bit about Rodeos and what you all do.
Rodeos brings the order of digital bits to the chaos of physical atoms. We specifically apply that to mini proteins and protein therapeutic design with our lab-in-the-loop generative AI design engine. It's a long-winded way of saying we apply AI and next-generation technology to this long and arduous drug discovery process in biologics to rethink that as a drug design process.
Wonderful. So before we get into the details of what you just mentioned, I'd love to take a step back and talk about your background. We were joking that typically startup founders have a very nonlinear background, but I think yours is extra interesting. So I'd love to just spend a little bit of time getting to know how all of that led you and inspired you to build Rodeos.
So I started as a computer nerd, like we all maybe do in the AI world, and I was deep into computer science, deep into network security. And you know, at one point, I ran a network security challenge lab for 3,000 students in a tech camp. Went to school, studied computer engineering. I did computational mathematics, actually. And what I studied was dynamical systems on networks, which is a fancy way of saying rumor propagation across social networks. My paper in college was actually finding terrorist cells in the larger network, where the terrorist cell at my college was my choir. And that choir is how I got into my, where maybe you're talking about my nonlinear path, which is that after school, after undergrad, I did what every good math major does, and I started a music company. And that music company became the 8th largest recording studio in the country by revenue. And we did that by flipping the business model on its head. First of all, we applied technology where others weren't necessarily. So we rethought how we could record and process vocal music. But beyond that, we reworked the business models that we taught music groups how to fundraise and how to really create better businesses out of their music, which allowed them to do well as well. After about a decade in the industry, I wanted to do something more impactful. And so I started studying biology. I was actually really not great at biology in high school. And so I decided to start studying and did pretty well. And at the same time, I started studying biotech at one university. I was studying AI at the other university. And there was a clear disconnect, right? Where biologists were thinking in a certain way that was obviously very rooted in science as it should be and very rooted in rigorous processes, but they weren't thinking of getting assistance from computer systems. And perhaps that's from being burned by expert systems and things like this in the past where AI may have steered them wrong. But I saw a clear opportunity to apply AI more globally to the biological problem, let's say, at a very high level. And then I would go over to my AI instructors and talk about biology, and they would say, oh, no, that's not really, I'm a computer scientist. That's not really that interesting to me. So I decided to bring the Order of Digital Bits, the Chaos Physical, in the form of Ordeos, where my team is made up of molecular natives, we like to call them. So people who are either ML scientists with the biology problem or biologists with an ML problem, just people who are really obsessed with both sides. And we sit them in a journal club every week so that ML scientists teach the ML or the biologists ML and vice versa. But what came out in the early days was a realization that we could use multi-agent systems or large-scale distributed systems that learn from each other to study most biological problems. You think about amalgamations of cells, amalgamations of organs, amalgamations of whatever that might be, perhaps proteins, where agents interacting with each other become really good knowledge holds for this systems biology, this systems approach. As we were doing this, we also started playing with funny concept where could you write an abstract to a paper and have a protein come out of it? It turns out you could. So we were doing this in 2019, 2020. We realized it was a little far off before the days of ChatGPT. So we focused down on this design engine that could really pick apart the components of proteins. And so speaking of my nonlinear background, what we have today is more like an orchestra of models or a symphony of models that are all working together to create this gestalt of better protein.
Amazing. Before we get to the next question, I feel like I have to ask this. Who's harder to work with, musicians or scientists?
Oh, it's a great question. Oh, it really depends on the day. There are divas in both. There are exemplars in both. There are divas in both. There are difficult people in both. One thing that's useful, so in my music business, I was a producer, I was a live sound engineer, I was a business person, I was the janitor, I was everything. Okay. But as a part of being a recording engineer, you have to be a psychologist. So somebody walks into your studio, and if they're throwing off very professional vibes, you're throwing back very professional vibes. If they're throwing off very, I don't know, childlike vibes, whatever it is, throw back really quickly. And I think that is the same thing in science, where you have varying egos and varying specialties and varying what have you, and you just have to adapt the team mm-hmm. around you and the team you're working with into focusing on the problem at hand and getting the egos out of the way. And yeah.
Great. Okay. So let's dive back to the industry. We're all aware of some of the larger challenges facing the industry right now. But from your perspective, what are the most pressing challenges that you see and how do you see Ordeos integrating in to address those?
Yeah. So in semiconductors, we're all familiar with Moore's law, where number of transistors is doubling every time period. And in biology, we face Eroom's law, which is the opposite, which says the cost of a drug is in line with Moore's law. And the cost of that drug is not because drug hunters are being frivolous. It's not that we're spending money for the sake of it. It's that it's getting harder. And so there's more failure. And then the failure rate has not really changed over many years. We're still today, 90% of drugs that are discovered are failing before they reach the market. Everything stems from that. The high price of drugs, the failure rate of curing disease, all stems from this failure rate. If we can improve that probability of success, even 10%, 20%, our cost of drugs would decrease. Our ability to cure disease would increase. What I see is processes that are not designed to have a paradigm shift in this probability of success, but are an iterative improvement. What I mean by that is that we're still stuck in this discovery mindset where you're hunting for drugs that are okay. And then you're making those compromises, those okay drugs, better by engineering them. But why can't we design them up front? So I think the most pressing challenges are just this constant failing and processes that allow suboptimal molecules to move forward longer than they should.
So you all work on, I don't know how to call it, but maybe a new modality, right, of mini proteins, which are pretty new. What led you to focus on mini proteins? Tell us what they are. Why are they advantageous, right? Especially in this sort of framework of how you're thinking about designing up front rather than just working with what we have.
So mini proteins are very simple. They're 20 times smaller than antibodies, but equal in power and performance. There's a number of other benefits, but stepping back 10 to 20 years ago, there were really two main modalities. There were small molecules and antibodies, where small molecules were these toxic chemicals that you would add into your body and you would suffer from toxicity or imperfect binding, or there's all sorts of difficulties in the construction, but they are cheap to make and cheap to consume. Not to mention you can take them orally. Antibodies were discovered from natural forms and they're a natural response in the body, but they're large. They're very large. So large, in fact, that what we've seen over the years, there's a drug resistance comes from them. As in the oncology field, as the antibodies are trying to get into the tumor microenvironment, it takes too long because they're too big. So the tumor starts to elicit an immune response and picks them out and learns how to fight them off. What we would ideally look for is something that has the small size and penetration ability of small molecules, the targeting of antibodies, because I just listed a negative of antibodies, but they are also very strong binders, very specific binders. And that's what makes them sort of safe drugs in some sense. What we want is something that bridges that gap. And that's exactly where mini proteins come in. At Ordeos, we use the term mini protein a little bit more broadly. So we're covering both the canonical mini proteins. These are 40 to 80 amino acids. So they're very small, up to 10 kilodaltons, where they're typically tightly packed hydrophobic cores. They're nicely charged in such a way that they avoid proteolytic degradation, that are more stable, very high thermostabilities into the 80s and 90s Celsius. But then we also use mini proteins to cover small antibodies. And what I mean by that is single domain antibodies like VHH and VNAR. So these, again, have the specificity of antibodies, but they are easier to manufacture and they're easier to get deeply into membranes. When I say membranes, I don't just mean necessarily the tumor microenvironment, but I also mean membranes. So oral biologics, antibodies, it's really hard to get into an oral format because their large size and charge and all that makes it difficult to cross the epithelial layer of the gut, whereas mini proteins are uniquely suited to survive the pH environment and also to cross the epithelial layer. Same thing with the blood-brain barrier. We see antibodies that might be on the market today that may have some inefficient crossing of the blood-brain barrier, where it's not just going to be the small size, because of course adsorption is one thing, but the small size, the construct, the ability to design them easily will make it easier to cross that blood-brain barrier, leading to more effective neurological medicine. So at the time, we saw a real opportunity where it felt like an unseen path, or a path that was much less traveled. So we made this the center of our business. And so we design mini proteins all day, every day, and we only design mini proteins. There is one subtlety that I'll say. We focus on mini proteins. We don't do peptides. Peptides are wonderful in their own right, but they're smaller than 40 amino acids. So you typically don't have that domain structure that you would in a mini protein. They're normally unstructured or disordered, but they can penetrate deeply into cells. So there's some advantages, but we focused on mini proteins, which we see as a real opportunity on the market, not just to replace the existing antibodies with maybe something that is more effective at crossing those membranes or getting deep into tumor microenvironments, but also, as I said, creating medicines for where antibodies are not necessarily succeeding today, neurological or in oral delivery.
Yeah. And given that you're venturing into this new area of opportunity, have you found that you've had to build infrastructure or a toolbox around it just because there wasn't anything existing to tap into?
Yes, mostly on the data side, frankly, because protein, at the end, protein is a protein. I say that with a big grain of salt, understanding at minimum one difference between mini proteins and antibodies, even single domain antibodies, the binding interface is usually ordered on a mini protein. So you have a binding across something like a helix versus disordered in something like a CDR of an end. Yeah. On one hand, the same tooling most is transferable, but on the other hand, that's very important. And so we've had to get into a very careful data creation system where we're creating a large moat, mini protein specific data.
Yeah, well, they sound pretty incredible. Is there anything that you're compromising on when you are looking at mini proteins?
The two things that I've heard the most are half-life and the fear of immunogenicity. I'm very careful to say the fear of immunogenicity and not the immunogenicity, because antibodies, they have their own sort of issues, right? You're typically humanizing something that you've taken from a mouse or a monkey, and that is sometimes imperfect, and there's some immunogenicity that comes out of it. The concern with mini proteins is that they look less like the natural repertoire, and so it will be foreign by default. But the thing is, we're designing them from scratch. So we can design them with that immunogenicity in mind and remove that front such that you end up with a safer profile in the end. And then the half-life, again, they are smaller, so they're easier to clear, but there are all sorts of engineering tricks that we can use for that. Simply stabilizing them better, infusing them with FCs, pegulating them, adding disordered tails to extend the half-life. There are all sorts of methods to extend that half-life. And what I found is that there are worlds in which antibodies have too long of a half-life, right? So having these shorter half-life mini proteins allows you to configure them. So those are the two main things that we use.
Great. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about AI and machine learning. I know it's such a core component of the technology and the stack of what you're building. Can you first share just a little bit more?
Yes. AI ML is certainly at the top of everyone's vocabulary nowadays, especially this word generative AI. In the past, we had predictive AI, where you would be looking at a set of data and, you know, perhaps the temper stability or whatever that might be from that data. Generative AI flips that on its head and asks to describe the data that leads to those results. So internally at Ordeos, when we say that we're designing molecules or designing proteins, we've created systems that can look through all of the multimodal data around protein science and tell us what proteins would lead to the outputs that we're looking for. This is more commonplace nowadays, so people are familiar with things like AlphaFold or RF diffusion or any of the algorithms. But we're using our own variants of design system that allow us to design proteins. Then we're also using AI to evaluate, to format and evaluate those proteins in silico. And then we're using AI to learn and to teach the system how to make better proteins. So saying that a little more concretely, we have generators or generative models that are generating these proteins. You can generate the atomic positions of proteins, then you have to back translate that into sequence. So there's something there. And then you can modify from there, going back from sequence to structure and structure to sequence to get more confidence. And then within that, we have various algorithms that are looking at things like simply isoelectric point or structure stability or thermostability. These are deep models or deep learning models that are taking the representations that we have of those proteins and predicting out physicochemical properties or interaction results. And with that, it used to be a few years ago, you would say, what AI are you doing? And people would say transformers or CNNs or LSTM. Now the answer is all of them. And especially in doing AI for bio, you're using an amalgamation of all the latest foundation models to build a system that works together into a gestalt, right? And the final component there, I mentioned that our system learns. So we're leveraging reinforcement learning and active learning to optimize information flow. What I mean by that is, if you think of the traditional process of protein discovery in pharma or in biotech, you're creating design libraries, or you're creating discovery libraries, I should say, where you have millions or billions of molecules, and you're running those millions or billions of molecules through a functional screen. So out of those millions or billions, you might get 400 that have some function. But of course, now you're taking those 400 and improving them in some way, which takes months or years. When our system proposes proteins, it first evaluates and it feeds those results directly back into its design system so that the next set of candidates avoid the limitations that you found in that first screen. And this is over and over again in silico in a reinforcement learning loop that then allows us to test far fewer molecules and have far better results far faster. And then on the active learning side, there's a difference between optimizing the molecule, so making better and better molecules, versus asking the models what they need to be better. So in the active learning case, we're perhaps it's a target that we don't know much about or something to that effect. And we're asking the model, what sequences would you really like to know? What do you have little confidence, but you understand that with a little more information, you can get better. And with that, we're synthesizing data that the AI is asking for. So the AI is like a hungry student, just, you know, for more and more data that we're feeding it to improve the models as we improve the model.
I think when we talk about AI ML, I've interpreted in my take, it's another tool. And I think especially with generative AI, it's a very new technology that's constantly evolving. And I don't even think experts truly understand the potential of what we can do, especially in these very specific industries, say drug discovery or life sciences. So I just saw in Silico an article, I think it was this week or perhaps last week, it was a paper in Nature Biotechnology where they offered a blueprint for pharma and biotech on how to use AI ML and discovery. And part of that was, I think, to show how the sausage is made in their processes in terms of using AI in drug discovery. What is your take on where we are in the AI adoption cycle with pharma biotech? Do they care? Is it a buzzword? Can you bury it? This is another tool that we're using in the stack, but ultimately what you're getting is a therapeutic, right? With all these improved properties.
Alex and InSilico are the goals. They rethink things from first principles, and they follow the same sort of methodology that we do of really just asking, why are we doing it this way and why can't we do it better? So that article was really fantastic at trusting the computer to do every stage of the process. So starting from target discovery to target validation to hit discovery and optimization, all the way through, they simply ask the computer over and over again, what do you want to do? And what we see in industry today is it's looked at as a tool and not as a co-pilot. So InSilico is able to use it as a co-pilot and say, no, let's collaborate together on this project. In industry today, people are looking at something like AlphaFold and say, oh, this is a faster alternative to NMR. They're not saying, how important is structure? How can I look at structure to get more information that I don't currently have today? Or how do I integrate all of the millions of structures into knowledge that I wouldn't otherwise be able to append as a human, let's say. So it's more than a buzzword. And there's a really interesting thing that's happening right now in industry where you go into a meeting with an exec at a pharmaceutical, they talk to you about AlphaFold or they talk to you about the latest paper from the Baker Lab. So there's a ton of interest right now. And we're past the point where people are saying, oh, AI, I'll never trust that. Mm-hmm. But the method upon which people are leveraging it is still with a lot of skepticism. So they're still treating it as a tool rather than a co-pilot. Now, that's for good reason, as again, it's amazing society now stands all of these terms that we've been thinking about as ML nerds for a long time, but hallucination, right? Everyone's familiar with this term hallucination. And you talk to something like a ChatGPT or a Gemini or whatever it might be, and you end up hearing some nonsense, right? And that's the absolute worst thing that can happen in a scientific setting. We're now having to get even more intelligent about how we're using retrieval augmented generation or any of these engineering tricks to ensure the AI is getting creative, but staying with the realm of reality.
Yeah. And I'll do a little plug here. We actually had Alex from InSilico on the podcast. So for those that are interested, definitely go back a few episodes and look for that one. So I love this idea of, yeah, right now it is a tool, but that's because we haven't necessarily pressed it, right? And had the data to be able to evolve it into a pilot that we all trust. What's the most unexpected thing that's happened to you as you're building Ardeus?
On one side, the results that we get from AI, the power of AI, was even more shocking than I expected. So just the simple fact that we can type a few sentences or a few letters into our computer and get out on the other side actual protein that actually does what we want, it just continues to surprise me every day. On the non-scientific side, the contraction, I think, really shocked all of us with how far the contraction went in the sort of 2021 to 2023 timeline. So it was shocking to see the world react maybe less optimally to something like a global pandemic in terms of research spending and biotech spending. But on the other side, it forced everyone to get a little more innovative and a little more rigorous and a little more resilient. Some great things that came out of that.
Assume we can time travel, right? But I think let's use 15, 20 years. What does like the pharma discovery process that you hope looks like? And how you know we've made sort of significant progress, assuming maybe there is this co-pilot model that's happening and we're leaving a lot more of that design process to the machine or computer?
It's a great question. And 15 to 20 years from now, I think everything I'm about to say is going to be wrong because it'll happen much sooner. Because now what we're seeing with AI,
right, like the optimism.
Yeah, what we're seeing with AI and ML is just a massive exponential increase. And it's not just on the technology side, it's in people's acceptance of these new technologies. They simply cannot stand in the way of it longer, right? So the first answer I would give is that in 15 to 20 years, there will be no such thing as drug discovery. It will in the history books, what we will have is drug design. And from that, processes will be much faster and more effective. Because currently today, it takes 5-6 years to discover a drug before you can get in the clinic. I'd like to see that 6 months or less. I gave a talk at JP Morgan this year where I tied drug discovery to the Formula One racing. F1 had a problem over the years. So if you went and looked at the time of pit stops, in the early years, it was something like a minute and a half for pit stops taken during a race where the margin of a win was 60 seconds.
Dependent on that, right?
Right? So your pit stops were actually determining your position. Even 10, 15 years ago, you were still seeing 10 or 12 second pit stop, but a 6 second margin of win. Today, the world record for pit stops is shocking. It's, I believe, 2 seconds. Which is an absolute technological feat, but it's also an organizational feat. And the reason that's important is that today, on average, cancer patients across all oncology live an average of 6 years, but it takes us 9 years to bring a drug to market. So clearly, as these diseases are progressing, we're losing the battle to disease. But in the future, you imagine a world in which that design realm is getting us down to 6 months or less. It's not just going to happen in terms of AI. There's going to have other improvements. I'm really heartened by the FDA Modernization Act of 2021. It says that we don't necessarily need to use animal models or don't necessarily need to use in vivo models to get a drug into human. The value of that is, as we keep saying with these imperfect compromises, mice or monkeys or what have you are just not humans. So there's always a little stretch that you're making by saying, well, it worked in mice, so it should theoretically work in human. But now, imagine if we are using human tissue regularly in the design process where we can leverage things like organoids or patient-derived cells to get direct readouts of that effect in human. And what's more, we're going to have to get past this target-only view or this single-target view where we start looking at systems. So once we have that human tissue, we can look at not just upregulation or downregulation of targets, but look at the entire expression profile, the entire change from disease state to healthy state. And that's another thing where AI can really benefit to take that complex information and whittle it down to a causal basis.
All right. So what's your prediction for how long it takes from drug design to FDA approval in, let's say, 15 to 20 years?
Ooh, putting me on the spot. So I will preface by saying I am highly confident we'll get to IND in 6 months, from idea to IND in 6 months.
That is very impressive in itself.
What I'm clear on, and I think there's a lot of debate on, is how that will affect clinical trial phase. Because right now it takes on average 5-6 years through all the way through clinical trials. But we've seen in the past where phase 1 data is so good that the later cycles are shortened. Now with AI and ML making things more efficient, why can't the later trials be shorter, be more powerful, but have fewer samples, right? I think we will see.
Yeah, perhaps more data points as well, right? To your point, perhaps completely eliminating the animal models because we clearly see they're not representative or fully indicative outcomes for human clinical trials. Are we able to design systems using organ-on-a-chip, organoid, those types of materials where we're able to collect a lot more data? And on top of that, we think AI, ML to better infer the performance of the therapy.
Exactly. And a number of potential outcomes and fast track past phase 1, or your phase 1 and phase 2 show such great data that you're shrinking phase 3. So many ways to go about it. Mm-hmm. But I think in the end, you're going to see those 5 or 6 years come down, perhaps 3, maybe even less. So now your entire time to release drug is 4 years or less. And I'm talking on average. I know in COVID, we got some things out pretty fast. The net effect to time has not decreased. I think we will see that in the next 10 years.
What advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs that are listening in?
So the advice I would give is twofold. One, persistence is your friend. Starting a company is not easy. It's also incredibly rewarding. And the best thing you can do is just survive and keep trying. The other advice I would give is to think like a rocket scientist. There's a fantastic book out there called Think Like a Rocket Scientist. It talks about first principle thinking. So when you're starting a business, if you're taking the dogma of everyone around you, there's nothing unique about your business, right? So as you're starting a new technological venture or a new business model or what have you, you have to ask these very smart people around me that I respect very much. What have they gotten completely wrong? What are they simply looking at in a way that makes no actual sense? And you have to challenge that constantly. And what I mean, in every meeting, you're asking the person that you respect very well, what assumptions are you making and what's the foundation of those assumptions? A lot of what we're doing now is just challenging years and years of biological assumptions that turns out are flat out wrong.
Yeah. Challenge the status quo, right? Because again, yes. Nothing innovative out of incremental thinking here. Think big, everyone.
Yeah.
All right. Dave, thank you so much for your time. This was such a thoughtful and insightful conversation. And again, I'll come back to you in 10 to 15 years and we'll see what that cycle looks like.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.